Good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm George Smith, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and your chair for today's program. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now I'm pleased to introduce our distinguished speaker, Gary Schlossberg, Vice President and Senior Economist for Wells Capital Management, a division of Wells Fargo. Mr. Schlossberg analyzes the economic, financial, and investment environment for Wells Capital Management, a fee-based institutional money manager with over $340 billion in assets. Prior to joining Wells Fargo in 1974, Mr. Schlossberg worked as a researcher at the U.S. Treasury and Federal Reserve Board covering international economic conditions. He did his graduate work at Pennsylvania State University and is a native of New York. He is often quoted in the financial press and appears on business, radio, and TV programs here in Japan and in the U.K. Today, Mr. Schlossberg will give a mid-year economic assessment as we look toward the rest of 2015 and beyond. Please welcome Gary Schlossberg.
Thank you, George. A pleasure to be back. I guess I addressed this group several years ago. Of course, you know, as you get older, the time frame varies a bit. It could be 10 years ago, for all I know, but it was at the old location. I think the short version of George's introduction is that I'm a dinosaur. I've been around a while. There's a certain advantage to that. When you look back over the years, I can remember actually following the economy. And as I continue on, there are fewer and fewer people that can draw on the firsthand experience, so I find I can get away with more and more as I discuss the outlook. Fortunately, we have a clock there, and I'll be able to keep to time. I'd like to spend about 25 minutes or so or until I get the signal to pause for questions. I'll try to cover as much as I can in that time, and hopefully we can flesh it out during the question and answer period. It is a large enough group, so I've got to ask you, no hardballs, softballs. Don't embarrass me in front of a large group, if you would. Appreciate that. On the economy itself, I think it's no secret that the U.S. and, frankly, the global economy continue to struggle through not only a weak but a very stop-go economic recovery. It's been a long one, 6 years, began in the middle of 2009, but considering the depth of the recession that preceded it, the deepest recession since the 1930s depression, we would have expected more. Typically, you get a much stronger recovery. The U.S. At the moment is once again trying to emerge from a weak start to the new year. We are picking up speed. Unfortunately, growth is nearly as strong as the rate that we saw last spring and summer when the economy recorded a rate of 4 to 5%, one of the strongest growth rates so far in this recovery. The good news is that the fundamentals driving economic growth are still pretty much in place. Income growth is holding up reasonably well. We have a lot of dry powder. Saving rates are on the high side. The big loss in wealth from the big drop in home values and stock values, stock prices following the financial meltdown in 2008-2009 are pretty much behind us. The rapid increases, and we're looking at double-digit increases in home prices. Sometimes you wonder if they're not triple-digit here in the Bay Area, but double-digit overall. The very strong rally in the stock market, which losing some momentum but continuing. The wealth pretty much has returned to its long-term trend level that was by the boards during the aftermath of the meltdown. I think the really good news is that a lot of the strength that we've been seeing of late, and there hasn't been much of it. The numbers have been disappointing overall, but a lot of that strength has been in auto sales and housing activity. Hasn't been an explosive housing recovery, but we have seen strength there, and of course, auto sales at a 10-year high in May. These are the most economically sensitive sectors of the market. They tend to be on the leading edge of changes in consumer spending, and the fact that they are picking up, they're both obviously big-ticket items, postponable. capable, the fact that they are strong, a lot of things involved, but you've got to have the confidence to make purchases like that, and it's a good starting point. We have other headwinds to economic growth. Fuel prices are moving back up. They're still a good deal lower than they were a year ago, but the fact that they're moving higher means that purchasing power, again, is being squeezed just a bit as gasoline and other fuel prices move up from their low in January. And frankly, we're still dealing with structural changes, and we can get into that in more detail if you'd like. A lot of it has to do with demographics, the labor market, the fallout from the financial meltdown. Many of these structural weaknesses were there even before the economy went through a very deep recession. They were just masked, hidden by the boom in housing and the spillover effect it had on the economy, on wealth, consumer spending, but they're out there, and that will affect the longer-term outlook as we move beyond the next year or two, and still dealing, we think, with the aftermath of the meltdown in the financial markets. The tendency of people to hoard cash. We went through a life-changing experience in 2008, 2009. It was a bona fide credit freeze. This wasn't simply a rise in interest rates slowly squeezing the economy. It was a major disruption in the fall of 2008. And much like the Great Depression, that impact lingers on. A reluctance to really build up debt in a big way, household debt, and that restraining spending as well. There are pockets. Auto credit is fueling the very strong growth in auto sales. But generally speaking, this economy, and it's not a bad thing, is not nearly as levered up, not nearly as burdened by debt as it was in 2007, 2008. But like a lot of things in economics, it's a double-edged sword. It means that people aren't spending as rapidly as we'd like to see them to pull ourselves out of what still is a fairly deep hole dug by that deep recession. The U.S. is the locomotive of global economic growth. The baton has been passed from China, which carried it early in this economic recovery. Historically, the U.S. has been the locomotive. If you go back over the decades, we're one of the largest economies in the world. Europe is larger as a bloc. By some estimates, China is as large as the U.S., believe it or not. But the fact is that we're still a powerhouse in the global economy, and we have the most momentum. Our growth may not be as strong as China's and certain other countries, but China is clearly struggling. In fact, that 7% growth rate is looking increasingly suspect. But their growth is stronger than the U.S., but it's not with a whole lot of momentum. The U.S. momentum has faded. Our locomotive role isn't quite as strong as it was a year ago. But given the fact that we're in the best shape of the major economic blocks in the world means that we're still in that role. Europe and Japan aren't acting as the drag on activity that they did a year ago. A lot of monetary stimulus has helped the economies there along. Their growth rate is still a fraction of that in the U.S., but at least it's contributing to global economic growth. China, as I said, struggling with the burden of debt that was built up immediately after the upheaval in the financial market back in 2008, 2009, in an effort to insulate themselves from the global economic slowdown. The Chinese authorities opened the floodgates, central bank stimulus, fiscal stimulus, encouraging the provinces to borrow, the local authorities, and now they're dealing with the aftermath of that. On top of that, the economy is maturing. They're moving beyond investment and export-led growth as their economy, their living standards improve, their incomes rise, their competitiveness globally is eroded a bit by a rising exchange rate, double-digit increases in wages. They're moving more toward a consumer-led economic growth model. It's not in a straight line. They're reverting back to the old strategy in an effort to get growth up to a more acceptable level. They, like a lot of countries, have social and political pressures that can really intensify if their growth rate lags a bit. But at the moment, at least, to some extent, it's been pushing on a string. We fully expect China's growth rate to pick up to some extent, but not the engine of growth, global growth, that we saw a few years ago. The emerging markets, still tethered to some extent to China, the U.S., hurt by a variety of things. Their debt burdens are on the high side, their current account deficits. It varies. We don't want to paint them all with the same brush. Some countries are in better shape than others, But by and large, a strong dollar has aggravated the slump in commodity prices, and that's hurt commodity producers. The weakness in China's economy, weakening demand for commodities has certainly hurt producers there as well. The strong dollar has had a twofold effect on emerging markets generally. When the dollar is strengthening, usually it's not always, but usually associated with higher interest rates, it draws capital, funds, investment, from these emerging markets. And so liquidity, funds, tend to dry up a bit. At the same time, the dollar debt of many countries, both from corporations and by governments, denominated in dollars, but very often paid off in local currency, when the dollar rises in value, it simply means that debt becomes more burdensome. It takes more of their local currency to pay off that debt. And that could be a big issue down the road, but for many countries, especially the more indebted countries, like Turkey and South Africa, Brazil to some extent, with large dollar debt, that is an issue as well, weighing on economic growth. In an effort to try to counter the outflow of capital, central banks have at times raised interest rates. That's burdensome for the local economies. So generally speaking, the focus continues to be on the U.S. Now, that has a spillover to the financial markets as well. We have a very varied pace of activity. In fact, we're at different stages of the economic cycle when you look across some of the major economic blocks. The U.S. is further along in trying to extricate itself from some fundamental economic weaknesses. You hear a lot of talk about the Federal Reserve positioning the market toward normalizing interest rates. And that may seem like semantics. When you raise interest rates, you're tightening credit. But the fact is, there is an element of truth to that. These interest rates are extraordinarily low, in some ways artificially low. And what the Federal Reserve will be trying to do early on is just getting those interest rates back up in line with economic growth and inflation. As low as both are, those interest rates are low relative to where the economy is at the moment. We hear a lot of talk about a looming interest rate increase in the U.S. At the same time, central banks in Europe and Japan, still dealing with the weaknesses that we dealt with a few years ago, are still opening the floodgates. And in fact, in a speech just today, President Draghi from the European Central Bank said that the ECB has every intention of continuing to stimulate until they can get the economy truly back on its feet. China doing much the same thing at the moment. You may know about the boom in the stock market, again, a byproduct of the very aggressive stimulus trying to inflate asset values. And if we do move, as we move, if we move early, that could have the effect of elevating the dollar, much as we saw early this year when there was a lot of speculation about U.S. interest rates rising sooner than later at a time when other countries are trying to keep their interest rates well down. That draws money to the U.S. It can weaken other currencies, which isn't all that bad in the view of the national authorities because it improves their competitive position. But at the same time, it can raise interest rates. As money comes out, you don't have as much of a supply of funds in your home market, and that can create problems for local economies. And generally speaking, it can create more instability, more volatility in the market as the market adjusts to variations in interest rates. Now, let me just focus for a minute on the U.S. Financial outlook. When it comes to forecasting, generally, we tell people you have to give them dates and give them numbers, but never give them dates and numbers together. When it comes to the Federal Reserve, though, we know the dates that they're meeting, and we have a pretty good idea of how quickly they'll raise interest rates. There are six meetings or so each year. Four of them, in March, June, September, and December, are accompanied by press conferences. The Federal Reserve hasn't raised interest rates in 10 years. I mean, there are people, younger people, in on our trading floor that really don't know a market where interest rates are rising. They've only gone down and stayed down. This is going to be a sea change in monetary policy, fundamental change in policy. Believe me, the Federal Reserve is going to want to have a press conference to explain themselves. Never say never, but I'd be very surprised if they didn't move when they do move at a meeting and where there's a press conference, March, June, September, December. Very unlikely that they're going to move in another week or two based on the economic numbers that we've been seeing, still very mixed. A possibility that the numbers will improve, and that's really the key. The economy has to show more broad-based strength. Inflation has to be turning the corner, as it is showing signs of doing. Wages improving, still very mixed, but we have a sense that they're beginning to turn the corner. Our best guess at this point is December. This is one of those instances where you forecast something long enough, it'll eventually come true. We've been talking about higher interest rates for 2 or 3 years now. But we do think the Fed will be moving in December if the numbers play out the way we think they will, the economy slowly gathering momentum. Very gradual, very cautious as they try to get their feet on the ground and position the financial markets and the economy for a more sustained but very gradual rise in interest rates. Some volatility that goes with it, years of very aggressive stimulus, have resulted in distortions in the financial markets, many of them not unlike what we saw in 2006, 2007, before the big meltdown in the financial markets. The big difference is we're not really levered up. We don't have these heavy debt burdens. But there are stresses and strains in the market which could create issues. Volatility, perhaps the economy suffering to some extent as the Fed makes this transition. The truth is we don't know how the economy is going to play out, but it's a safe bet that there will be more volatility in stocks, bonds, other financial assets, really across the board, commodities as well. The other economies we think will lag the U.S., but we see a slow turn, very flat trajectory as the economy slowly turns the corner here and acts again as a locomotive for some of the emerging markets. Support to Europe. Many of those economies are more export-oriented. Japan as well, really relying on its own traditional model, trying to get the yen down, which it has. The yen is at a, Japanese yen is now at a 12-year low against the dollar. Export competitiveness has improved. It really extends beyond that. If you're a car company, electronics company, any company selling abroad, and you're earning money in dollars, or if you're a multinational, earning funds in dollars. When it comes time to repatriate that money to Japan, for example, or simply report it for reporting purposes, translating it back into Japanese yen, you're going to be fetching more yen for each dollar if your exchange rate is going down. That's what's called a translation gain. Our multinationals suffered big translation losses in the first quarter of the year because the dollar was going up. And that whole example worked in reverse. Fewer dollars for a given amount of foreign currency. And so it has really been a goal, I think, of central banks for a variety of reasons to get those rates down. Japan, we think, will recover as they're pulled along very gradually by the U.S., hopefully China picking up speed as well, the emerging markets as well. But it will be a very slow process, and really taking the longer view, we think that there are a number of headwinds out there to keep this growth recovery very moderate. We're hopeful that we're wrong. We're hopeful that we're underestimating the economy's inherent strength. There's got to be some pent-up demand out there after years of very weak economic growth. But there are some issues we have to deal with as well. Some are demographic. We're dealing with an older, slower-growing workforce. We were before the meltdown in the financial markets, but it was hidden by the big boom in housing, as I said, and some of the strength that we were seeing. The labor markets themselves have changed. The environment that they're operating in is different. There's a mismatch between a large number of unemployed, unskilled workers or less skilled workers and strong demand for skilled workers. The extreme is right here in the Bay Area, but it really extends beyond that. In the trucking industry, skilled manufacturing, many baby boomers, welders, other skilled manufacturing workers are retiring. And there is a tightness in the labor market. A couple of statistics highlighting that. The Labor Department publishes detail on employment with about a one-month lag. But one of the things they include is the number of job openings. The number of job openings are up 25% year over year, very, very strong. Hiring is up by a good amount as well, but it's 8%. It's only a third of the growth in openings. There are a lot of positions that are out there, but for a variety of reasons, one of which is that mismatch, businesses aren't getting the workers that they need for those jobs. Small businesses being surveyed, one of the questions in an optimism index that the National Federation of Independent Business, their trade association, includes in what's called a sentiment index for small business, an optimism index. Are you having trouble finding at least one worker, trouble filling one position? And if you answer yes to that one position, it's tallied up in that way. The percent of firms reporting difficulty in filling at least one position well above its long-term norm at about 26-27%. Here again, that mismatch coming into play. The market is changing. We have an on-demand labor market now that's becoming increasingly important. The Wall Street Journal had a piece about this. Inherent in that market is greater volatility in incomes. When your income is more volatile, you tend to save more. You tend to spend less. That can hold back the economy as well. The after effects of the meltdown in the financial markets, the volatility that we can expect to see in the financial markets as well, it's really inherent, and I'm jumping around a bit here, my apologies, but one of the hurdles to growth could be inherently more volatile financial markets. When I was going to school, and I'll be dating myself, inflation was in the upper single digits, and it eventually peaked in double digits a good deal later. But it was in the upper single digits, and we all, nirvana, we were told, was an inflation rate of about 2%. Well, we bested that. We dropped below 2%. The problem with a low inflation rate is that interest rates tend to be low as well. They don't have to be as low as they are now, but even without the Federal Reserve stimulating the economy, when you get low inflation, long-term rates come down, and the Federal Reserve doesn't have to keep short rates elevated. It can drop them down as well. You get a situation where people, either out of greed or out of necessity, reach for return, reach for yield in increasingly risky assets. A lot of greed in the financial community, perhaps, a lot of greed among households, but look at insurance companies and pension funds. They have liability targets that they have to meet. Their workers, they know, are going to be retiring at a certain rate. They know what their, more or less, what their the payout needs are going to be. At times, a 2-3% yield on a 10 or 30-year treasury bond just isn't going to cover it. So they really have no choice. And the result is that investors, institutional and individual at times, will look for the next big thing. And this predates the upheaval in the financial market 6 or 7 years ago. Back in the late 90s, the stock market boom and bust, the commodity supercycle, due to a lot of things, but one of which, aggravating that supercycle, were investors piling in and trying to generate returns as fundamentals began to improve and prices began to move up. The housing boom, another example. Treasuries, arguably, might be in a bubble as well. Their prices are high, the yields are low. The question that I'm asked often is, all right, well, what's the next big thing? Well, I don't know what the next big thing is going to be. If I did, I wouldn't be working for a bank, is the flip answer. But the ingredients are there for that kind of reach for yield, for improvements in the market to be accentuated by investors piling in. And then when the fundamentals begin to deteriorate, demand weakens, interest rates go up, as we saw in the housing bust, everybody piles out. And if that's not enough, typically short-term borrowing costs tend to be lower than the investment yield. What does that mean? People lever up. They borrow to invest to try to juice those returns a bit. Everybody becomes a bank, in other words, funding short and investing long. And those kind of ingredients can leave us very exposed to volatility in the market, which makes investment difficult, the kind of investment-led growth that we need so desperately now to boost productivity. Let me just end on a more upbeat note. I think I have about 2 minutes before we turn it over for questions. Having said all that, we think the opportunities are extraordinary out there. Even if the global economy doesn't grow that rapidly, even if our own growth rate isn't as strong as it was years ago, during the early period, out beyond the next few years, there are still opportunities out there for companies, for investors. And I might add, the volatility in the financial markets, I'd be remiss if I didn't round that out by saying that doesn't mean you stuff your money in a mattress, you're earning nothing, but it does mean you fall back on the blocking and tackling, the diversification, understanding your portfolio, understanding the risk in that portfolio, understanding what you're invested in. But back to the positives and the longer-term outlook, we're dealing with an aging population, new opportunities in consumer markets. Aging baby boomers, the millennials aging, going through their life cycle. Might be a little bit different this time around. Student debt is a big issue. The younger people are more heavily indebted. They may not be spending in the way that past generations did. But there are demographic opportunities as these markets are changing. The developing, the emerging markets, the opportunities there. an emerging middle class, the infrastructural opportunities that are out there, not only to expand infrastructure and help finance it, generate a return in those areas, but also to upgrade infrastructure here. I'm sure you've heard about the deficiencies, the opportunities that are developing there. The growth that we see in some of these markets, as I mentioned, we expect to be getting by some of the distortions from the meltdown, the upheaval in the financial markets as we move beyond the next few years. Consumers should be spending and borrowing a little bit more freely than they have over the past couple of years as well. So the big key in terms of growth potential, though, moving further out, is to encourage investment. When you encourage investment, which is sorely missing now, companies are focused more on buying back stocks, paying dividends, buying other companies to try to generate the returns. When we start seeing investment pick up, that's going to be a key. That'll be a signal that worker productivity will benefit as well. We've seen so little investment over the last couple of years, at times our stock of investment actually has diminished. Depreciation of the existing equipment has exceeded the new investment. We've improved beyond that, but certainly that, and it's going to be a challenge in the next few years. But as we ramp up our investment, we expect to see productivity improve. That's one of two key components in growth potential. And over the longer term, hopefully we'll see the economy returning back toward the kind of growth rate that we were accustomed to in decades past. Well, I think I'm right at six. I'm amazed. I usually get up here thinking I'm being paid by the word, especially when I don't have a clock and I run over. But why don't I pause here and we'll turn it over to Tom for the Q&A period.
Thank you, Gary. And I might add, without notes, that's fairly impressive. So let me just apologize in advance. I can't possibly get to all the questions, and I can't read some of the handwriting. My name is Tom Burkhardt. I'm on the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club, and it's my pleasure to be the moderator today for the audience questions. So, wow, we've got some good ones, Gary. The first one...
Hopefully not too good.
How does the presidential election affect the economic outlook?
Well, we're just getting into the presidential season, so we'll have to see how it, you know, the candidates play out. There's obviously a multitude on the Republican side, and the numbers are growing on the Democratic side as well. I think, you know, if the past is prologue, the concern I think many of us have, to the extent that it affects the economy, is the way the pendulum has swung. When we talk about some of the hurdles to economic growth, having been around a while and seen policy developed and compromise, what the sense you get is that the two parties are becoming obviously increasingly polarized. And the corollary to that is that the swings in economic policy, the uncertainties facing businesses and consumers, for that matter, over tax policy, regulatory policy, the swings have become greater and the uncertainties have increased. I don't really see that changing in the next presidential election. Of course, you know, if the Republicans do win the next election, based on what we've seen in the last 5-10 years, we could expect to see another wrenching adjustment on policy, and that could do more harm than good. We'll have to see how it plays out, what issues develop, but certainly something we'd be watching.
You mentioned unfunded public pension debt. What's going to happen? I mean, they can't possibly meet the demand of the liabilities. So what do you forecast?
Well, some areas, and it's very uneven, clearly. I mean, when we talk about public pensions, we're talking about pensions at the state level, at the local level. Some areas are certainly closer to the edge than others, Illinois, Chicago being a good example of that, where they're having trouble funding at a reasonable cost because their credit rating is already beginning to suffer. By and large, I would say if you were to generalize for the country as a whole, this is really more of a corrosive issue, more of a long-term issue of slowly seeing spending being diverted toward pension liabilities, taxes being raised, the economy suffering to some extent. You want to be careful here. I mean, it's a politically charged issue, of course, but I think what you'll see as these states and localities come under more and more pressure is growing pressure for reforms, growing pressure to shift from a defined benefit plan where The payouts are guaranteed to a defined contribution plan where the benefit plan may be grandfathered, but shift to 401ks where the risk is borne by the worker with some backstopping by the employer, namely the state and local governments. But I think you're going to see give all along the way, contributions to health care, contributions to pension benefits going up a bit as they're reformed, perhaps philosophically, as I said, a shift from defined benefit to defined contribution plans. It's going to be more evolutionary for most entities around the country. For the Chicagos and the Illinois, however, it may be more abrupt because they are faced with more of a clear and present danger.
A local question, housing prices are through the roof. How's it going to end up?
We're talking hopefully not badly.
Yeah, we're talking you're a Bay Area guy, so we're talking housing prices keep going up and fewer people can afford to live here. What's the outcome?
Well, we are getting some venting. You're starting to see Oakland getting some of the spillover. I know I'm north of here, and the rents have been going up at a pretty good clip. I think at the end of the day, and certainly the young people like to, they'll sacrifice to live in the city. I'm absolutely floored. I could give you a first-hand example. My daughter has since moved on to a different location, but the rent increases, especially when one of our roommates under rent control left, and rent control was bumped up, was lifted. But taking her out to dinner once a week, I was absolutely floored by how vibrant the city has become. I mean, it was vibrant enough, but by leaps and bounds from when I lived here. I mean, this is more of a generational thing. And I think all that to say that to some extent, to a considerable extent, these rents are driven by the economy. And San Francisco's economy, it seems to me, is a lot more vibrant, more highly charged than it was certainly when I moved out here in the 1970s. It was a mature, steady-eddy economy, high-value-added banking, financial services, business services, legal and the like. And now a lot of it is driven by tech and some of the biotech and some of the more dynamic industries. And I think the corollary to that, and we've seen that in the dot-com bust and the hiccups that we've seen in technology over the years, is that you do get an interruption. And when the market is as overheated or heated as it is now, I think it simply becomes more vulnerable to a pause or a setback. Now, the Bay Area is unique. One other last point. I remember during the dot-com bust, I was looking at prices, local home prices down in the Silicon Valley area. I think it was San Mateo and Santa Clara. And I remember right after the dot-com bust, those prices, and of course the dot-com boom affected San Francisco. I think it was one of the first waves. But even down there, prices dropped 30-35% of some of those homes down there. 6 months later, they were back. You get this backfilling of people moving in from the outlying areas that suddenly find the near places affordable. The restriction on supply cuts both ways. So we may have the correction. You never want to say never for a prolonged slump. But for a prolonged slump, I think you have to see this economy change, really go through years in the desert. And given that it's driven by tech, the way tech is going now and the opportunities longer term, I'm pretty optimistic on the housing market. I'm also friends with a realtor. She told me to say that, by the way.
There's so many takeoffs on that issue. The inequality of income and wealth. We're reading a lot about that.
Yeah,
what are your thoughts?
As you said, driving people out of the city. I know the city government is making an effort to try to allocate space, in effect. I think we see it to some extent up in Marin. I'm sure that other areas of the Bay Area see it as well, where mixed income housing is developing along the main transportation arteries. I've seen a few developments along 101 going north. You may see more of that down the road. Out beyond that, it's easy to say it's a difficult issue, but I think that's where the government gets more involved.
Yeah, and I think living in the Bay Area, we're a little jaded because other parts of the United States, things are fairly normal. But they seem normal here to us when in fact they're not. But
well, in fact, though, in 20 metro areas on home prices, the average increase has been over the last 3 months annualized about 11 or 12%. So there are a lot of metro areas where these price increases are strong. But to your point, I think we're one of the areas certainly on the leading edge.
And the other corollary question: the impact of 29% of elderly have savings less than $10,000. You know, which is that big gap we're talking about. So. All right. Greece defaulting on the debt. What's that going to do to the United States, if anything?
Well, I think there are enough unknowns about how it might affect Europe, and let's not rule it out of settlement. The market rallied today in part because there was some talk. Once again, at least the creditors have gotten together. They're unified. I think just hours ago they presented the Greek government with their final offer. Now, whether that truly is their final offer remains to be seen. What we do know is that the odds are Greece can meet a payment on June 5th. After that, all bets are off, and they risk falling off. Greece risks falling off a cliff. Now, what Greece might very well do is enact capital controls, more pain and suffering for the people in Greece. The European authorities have pretty much ring-fenced themselves as best they can. But I think it would be foolish to say that this is ironclad. There are so many possible unintended consequences from a Greek default. We don't know how investors might react toward other peripheral economies down the road. At the moment, Europe is slowly gathering momentum after going through another growth recession last year. That lessens the risk that there would be a run on any of those countries. In other words, an unloading of stocks and bonds from Portugal, from Ireland, I think, is in better shape, but perhaps Italy, Spain. We just don't know, but I would say there's less risk of that. But certainly the possibility of some fallout in Europe. The U.S., I think, the biggest impact magnified would be flight capital moving to the safety of the dollar if things really began to spin out of control with the euro. We don't think it's going to be likely, but that would be the most likely channel where treasury yields might be suppressed a bit, the dollar would move up in the currency markets, and then the fallout, positive and negative, would be felt over the next 12 to 18 months in terms of competitiveness and multinationals' earnings and the like.
It is quoted that Russia is dumping dollars. Is that true? And if so, what does that mean to the value of the U.S. dollar?
Well, I don't know if they're dumping. I mean, the only thing I'm aware of, and it's certainly possible that they're moving into other investments, but clearly their reserves, visible reserves, are way down. I can pull numbers from the air, but it just seemed to me that before the sanctions fully hit, they had reserves on the order of $550-575 billion. I think they're down to somewhere between $300-350 billion now. A lot of it has to do with backstopping the banking system, which is finding it difficult to borrow in the global financial markets. They're under sanctions. So a lot of the drawdown in dollars is out of necessity. Now, they may be switching their investments, just given the concern over asset freezes and the like. The key would be if they're actually converting and investing in other currencies, or are they just moving out of treasuries to other dollar investments and keeping those allocations pretty much unchanged. I'm not aware of any wholesale dumping, but I'm sure there's some because there is some concern down the road about an outright asset freeze. We seem to be moving in the other direction. Things have calmed down for a time, but this is clearly a volatile situation.
What percent of the U.S. public U.S. bond debt does China hold? And do you forecast any issues there if they decide to start selling?
Well, I don't know the exact amount or the share. I think it's over $1 trillion. But again, I'm pulling a number out of the air. The important thing is that they are one of three top investors in dollar-denominated securities. More importantly, I think, the Treasury securities. The issue and the question we get all the time is, what if China, for political reasons, suddenly decides to unload all their dollar holdings? They're doing that already. They're diversifying. I would say generally central banks have moved away from the idea of the dollar as liquidity, backstopping imports, payments needs. We're seeing sovereign wealth funds developing not only in oil-producing countries but outside as well. And the idea is to try to earn a better return on their investment. Now, if China were to unload their dollar holdings for political reasons, they end up shooting themselves in the foot to some extent because they're always going to have to hold on to a certain portion, at least in the foreseeable future. The dollar is the main key currency in world trade and finance. Now, China is moving up. It's still a small part, moving up quickly to develop the yuan as a reserve currency with all the advantages that attach. But the fact is that given the dollar's importance in global finance, the Chinese would still have to hold a significant amount of dollars for payments needs, for investments, and the like. And if they were to unload a good portion of that portfolio, it would just end up, because they are a big player, driving the price down of U.S. Treasury securities, and they would suffer big losses. So it's really in their interest, and their interest as one of the largest economies in the world, to maintain some measure of financial stability, not blow the system up, because then it ends up working at cross purposes with them. This isn't a closed economy anymore. They're an integral part of the world trade and payment system.
I hate to keep asking you such short questions because you have to give these long answers. I'm going to let you rest a little bit.
Like I said, I get paid by the word if I do it up there.
So you're talking really fast. So
sorry.
India. So India's been talking about we're going to be one of the most powerful economic systems in the world. Give us an update on India.
You know, you don't want to call it a Brazil. Brazil's been called the country of tomorrow, and it'll always be called the country of tomorrow. There are some tangible reforms. The new government in hasn't moved as quickly as some businesses would like them to move, but they are moving, and more importantly, philosophically, they're more toward an open, more market-oriented economy, which tends historically to generate better growth. Now, at the moment, on paper, the growth rate is very strong. I think the last estimate for the latest quarter was something like 7.5%, even stronger than China's. But there was just an article in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was today, about how it certainly doesn't feel like 7.5% growth. There are some clear hurdles. They've had their ups and downs. So even if they're growing rapidly, they may be growing rapidly out of a deep hole that they dug for themselves. Many people have said that the longer-term growth potential for India is greater than China's because it is a democracy, the world's largest democracy. And, if they can get their act together politically, and they certainly made strides in that direction, the potential with the right kind of economic policies is really enormous. At the moment, they were called one of the fragile five, I think, a year ago or 2 years ago, when the emerging markets really went through the ringer. They were thrown in with Indonesia, Turkey, South Africa, Brazil. And at the moment, I think they're probably one of the better-placed emerging markets now, certainly in terms of their performance of late. So they've made the strides. They have a long way to go, but I think they're certainly moving in the right direction.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and our guest today is Wells Capital Management Senior Economist Gary Schlossberg, who is giving us his economic forecasts for the rest of 2015.
So, I do that myself.
So, Gary, you got a little rest there. So, what about the infrastructure of the United States? We've been talking about the rest of the world. Are we keeping up? Do we have a problem there? Are we behind, ahead? Where are we?
Well, I think most people would agree, and certainly there's an Civil Engineers Association, that's a trade association that's come up with an estimate of trillions of dollars of needed infrastructural improvements to get us back up to speed. There's no doubt that there are areas of the country that need it. I think one of the big issues at the moment is financing. There are certain pension obligations, obligations for health care at the state and local level that have to be met. How binding they are still remains to be seen. There was a ruling in Illinois that said that those pension obligations are paramount. At the federal level, I believe there was a ruling that, certainly with respect to Detroit, which opened the door for some changes, if not on existing retirees, certainly those going forward. But I think given the magnitude, the real issue isn't so much are we going to upgrade the infrastructure. I think we have to as it continues to fall behind. Parts of it continue to crumble. The real issue is the financing. Where do we get the financing? And there really is a large pool out there of funds that can meet that need. There have been some starts and stops, private toll roads and the like, but when you marry the financing, the need for long-term returns by the big institutions like pension funds and insurance companies that I mentioned earlier, and you look at the longer-term financing needs that are involved in upgrading and expanding our infrastructure. They're apart right now, but there's a commonality there, and you've got to believe that that's going to be part of any future solution. Very difficult for state and local governments to meet those needs, given the current condition of the situation that they're in, even if growth does pick up out over the next few years?
I've got to ask this question.
As long as it's easy.
Is the stock market less volatile than it was 5 years ago? And here's really why I'm asking the question. What advice do you have regarding stock purchases?
That's a variation on, and I usually get this as, I have 1 foot out the elevator door in our office building. So where's the S&P? Where's the Dow going to be at the end of the year? Fortunately, the door closes, and I don't have to worry about giving an answer. I think certainly the market, if you look at the numbers, the fear gauge, the so-called VIX index, and I'll be happy to try to explain that if there's an interest, but it's certainly down. There's a lot of money out there at the moment, and it's pushing the market along. The Federal Reserve has succeeded in driving the yield, the return down on treasuries and other quality investments. Stocks are a quality investment as well, but historically they have been more volatile. But the returns have been higher there as well with that volatility, and it simply encouraged people to move into the stock market. Is it wildly overvalued? Two people will give you three different opinions. My own feeling is that at current interest rates, the market is not wildly overvalued. It is rich at the moment and vulnerable to a setback if rates move up or the economy slows. The short answer for those who want to invest in the market to me is, and we have some private bankers out here who probably can answer it better than I can, but you don't try to go with the flow of the market. You get back to basic blocking and tackling. You diversify, you come up with a portfolio that is you're comfortable with in terms of your risk tolerance. You can tweak it. And in that context, I would say that I wouldn't move out of the market, stock market, whole hog at the moment. I still think that the market does have some room to run. We're not looking at the kind of spectacular returns that we saw in 2013, to a lesser extent, 2014. And I can go through the litany if you'd like, but it just seems to me that the market is capable between now and the end of the year of returns in the mid-single digits, measured by the S&P 500. And there are some positives out there that I think support it, with the caveat that if the Federal Reserve does begin to raise interest rates sooner than expected and or the market overreacts to what they think the Fed will be doing by driving longer-term rates up, that does leave the market more vulnerable at these levels, price levels.
And here's speaking of interest rates and raising rates, the question is, why not keep interest rates low? I mean, why wouldn't the Fed do that? Why do they have to rise with the economy?
Well, I think there are two responses to that. The immediate is that there is a cost, and it's sort of a stealth cost, a hidden cost, if you will. And you don't hear the Fed really talking about it all that much. But with the Fed pumping a lot of money into the market, with the financial markets, with the stock market moving up, with other riskier assets moving up as well, the distortions that I spoke about earlier, with asset values becoming increasingly rich, with underwriting standards, when people make institutions make money available, the protections against a default, the protections against a mispayment and other features. Payment in kind loans, in other words, not with cash, but with more debt out there. These are the kinds of things that create problems down the road. But with the Federal Reserve pumping money in now, you get people lowering their guard, and you get distortions in the market. And that could create bigger problems down the road. If the economy does pick up and the Federal Reserve keeps its foot on the accelerator, ultimately, you can get higher inflation. We haven't seen it so far. So far, it's been the dog that hasn't barked, and I can give you reasons for that. But we are seeing inflation slowly turn the corner. And if, in fact, the labor market is tight enough, if the slack in the economy is diminished enough, continuing to pump money into the market as the linkages between the money the Fed pumps in and spending, and there are a couple there, begin to tighten a bit, the Fed can quickly fall behind the curve. And they only have so much control over interest rates. The best control that they have, short-term rates. Long-term rates can very often march to their own drummer, and they can move up. And the Federal Reserve can find themselves in a difficult situation.
Speaking of interest rates, where do you find yield these days?
Where do you find yield?
Well, there are a number of areas that naturally are vulnerable when interest rates move up, and I've already gotten hit to some. I should be asking you that.
Well.
He owned his own investment firm for a while, so far be it from me. But there are yield oriented. You look for the alternatives. Our own private banking group, Wealth Management Group, has talked about diversifying your income sources, moving beyond the traditional. Even within the traditional, muni bonds, there are pockets in the muni market where there are some real opportunities. There are parts of the corporate bond market that are still attractive, lower rated but still investment grade issues. But out beyond that, yield-oriented stocks, many of them are in utilities, telecommunications services, or you can just focus on those companies that have a history of not only providing a rich yield, but more importantly, a reliable yield, relatively rich. Reliable increases over time. REITs, real estate investment trusts, generate most of their income is given out as yield. Now, all these instruments can tend to be very vulnerable once interest rates begin to move up. But until they do, at the moment those rates, they have been moving up actually of late, but until we get a sustained rise there, if you're looking for that yield, there are areas where you can diversify and still generate the yield, not only short-term, but really taking more of a strategic view. Those interest rates aren't going to rise forever, and these could be opportunities for longer-term income.
I hear that loaning money to family members might be a good idea to get a high yield.
Usurious, actually, at times, but there are non-economic costs that go along with that.
We're all reading about the South China Sea and a potential conflict there, and politically speaking, talk about that for a second. What should we
worry
about?
Well, it's a hot button issue, of course, and how you deal with it is a hot button issue as well. But it's a major trade route, and it requires a lot of extrapolation. But if China does gain control as it wants over the entire South China Sea area, it just leaves you vulnerable when there are tensions developing. It becomes like a very wide Strait of Hormuz, and maybe that's not a good analogy, but it does become a choke point potentially if one country does control that entire area. So strictly from an economic standpoint, it does create a risk, an economic risk down the road. We're not there yet, but certainly you could see something like that developing. I would say just, on the point of geopolitical strains, and there are certainly plenty of them. In fact, by one estimate, there are more geopolitical hotspots in the world today than there have been at any time since the 1970s. I don't know if that means something. I remember that we had this Cold War with the Soviet Union at the time, and Iran, of course, was an issue. But in any event, there are a lot of hot-button issues out there, and investors tend to react to them. But the vast majority tend to be more hot spots. They affect the market, and then they dissipate, unless they have an economic impact. Oil prices are affected. Trade flows are affected. It has to have an enduring effect, I think, to really affect the market over time. And the majority so far have been really more, it's been more of a psychological impact. Hopefully it'll stay that way.
Yeah. Tough question.
Well, skip over it.
I'm putting my glasses on because some of you are writing really small. Mismatched labor force, particularly older workers who need income and cannot retire. Any incentives to reemploy this group of people?
There are a lot of facets to that. There are people that may have wanted to retire that can't retire. I mean, there's a world of hurt in the labor market. Don't be misled by a 5.4% unemployment rate. It may generate some wage pressures, but, you're dealing with a large number of people that are working part-time that would like to work full-time. You're dealing with a large number of people that simply have dropped out of the labor force, not even part of that 5.4%. If they've given up looking, then they're called discouraged workers. There is a broader measure of the unemployment rate, 10.8%, I think, currently, much higher. It typically is much higher than the official rate. But there are a lot of dislocations. What we're seeing are seniors in particular being rehired in advisory roles. Some seniors are going back to work or being reemployed at just a fraction of their income. I mean, there is clearly a downside to it, not only here, but particularly overseas. But there is an upside to it as well, generating income in an advisory role, flex hours, working for companies where they had been employed earlier, or simply coming back into the workforce to supplement income. But that's a far cry from working, being underemployed, going back into the labor force, working a job at just the fraction of the income that they made earlier.
What was the net effect of the federal government's bank bailout?
Net effect of the bailout, they got the money back that they put in with one or two exceptions. I think in the private sector, the auto industry, I think Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the only two that where there may still be an outstanding amount, but because the government is pretty much the dividend that they're earning is just about all their earnings under the agreement a few years ago, that should take care of itself. It seems to me there was one pocket where there's still about $30, $40 billion that still had to be paid out as of about a year ago. My information isn't terribly up to date, but the government, all in all, has received back the bulk of the TARP money that was paid out. And the money that was paid out wasn't the $900 billion in its entirety. There was some unspent money that was never dispersed.
Do you think banks are more stable now than they were?
Well, you know, I think the issue is larger than that. There are a lot of unintended consequences, and I'll be careful here because I'm wading into very sensitive territory. There's a conventional wisdom, and this is my own opinion. I work for a large financial institution, and so I've got to issue a disclaimer. But it just seems to me, first of all, that the meltdown, the upheaval, the turbulence in the market was truly a team effort in 2008, 2009. When you get into a mess like that, everybody's got to pull together, try real hard, and foul up. And I think that's what did happen. And I can go through a litany of reasons in retrospect why we had the issues. And I think the government was very much involved in it, at the very least, in laying out the environment. But that said, it is what it is. The regulations that went into effect, regardless of what you think of them, and I have some opinions about that as well that I won't share with you, but there have been some unintended consequences of the Dodd-Frank Act, one of which is it's like a balloon. You push in on one end, and that's what they've done with the traditional banking sector, to try to regulate it, try to regulate away a lot of the risks. Some people would argue make banks like utilities. I don't think we've gone that far, but certainly in that direction. But when you push in on one side, if the credit needs are there, you're going to get a bulge on the other side. And that bulge is quite simply the shadow banking system. That sounds more insidious than it really is. It's any institution, broadly defined, that doesn't accept deposits. Private equity, hedge funds, all the way down to securitized credits, which played such an important role in providing efficiency to the financial markets before the upheaval, got a little out of control, to say the least, but is beginning to come back. The problem is those institutions are less heavily regulated than banks, less heavily regulated than banks were, and less transparent in some cases before the upheaval in the financial market. So we're left with a system at the moment that might be more lightly regulated or less regulated than the financial system as a whole back in 2006, 2007, before the market unraveled. The other point on unintended consequences, some of you may be familiar with what's happening in the corporate market. Because the liquidity rules and the capital rules on banks are so stringent, the cost of holding certain types of securities, notably corporate bonds, is so much larger now. Banks are not holding the inventory of those bonds and acting as a market maker or a middle person between buyers and sellers. That hasn't been an issue because everybody's rushing into the market to invest. But when the bell goes off and those rates start moving up and people want to move out, there could be some issues of liquidity. Liquidity risk, the ability to get your money back on your investments, may be impaired to some extent. We just don't know how much, but it's one of the unanswered questions. As I speak, innovations in the market are getting around that, are dealing with it, adjusting with it, but there is an element there. Your questions are getting too hard. That's why my answers are longer.
I know.
I can get by the 7 o'clock hour.
There are hundreds of thousands of small businesses in the United States.
Yes.
And there's always been problems with banks lending to small businesses. Do you want to comment about that?
Well, I think before the 2008-2009 issue, I think there was a reasonably good flow of credit. to small business. I wouldn't say all the needs were met. Clearly, there were periods, and that's another question that's asked by that National Federation of Independent Businesses. Are you having trouble getting credit? And not surprisingly, the percentage went up and down depending on the availability of credit in the market. We did have a fairly vibrant community banking sector, small banking sector, and we were even seeing innovations in the financial market, financing, that would provide more credit available to small businesses. Securitization, that is a bank originating a loan, much like a mortgage, packaging those loans together, issuing a security to an investor who funded that security and paid banks off, in effect. Banks would act as conduits, taking the funds that were used to pay the loans by small businesses, paying back the investors. We were beginning to see a diversification there. Small businesses, since the meltdown in the financial markets, have been the laggard. I mean, the flow of credit has been very uneven. A lot of money going to businesses, a lot of money going for auto loans, not so much money going to smaller businesses as there were earlier. The recovery has been weaker. Small businesses tend to have a thinner financial cushion. Banks tend to be more reticent, even smaller banks in this environment. So, yes, there's an issue. I wouldn't say it's been historic, but it's a natural reflection, I think, of a very stop-go, slow-growth economy and a financial market that's still dealing with the after-effects of the meltdown psychologically and financially from 2008-2009.
Well, we're right down to the final few minutes, and as a moderator, I get the last question, so I want to save an extra minute or two for that.
Okay.
My wife and I just came back from Iran about a week ago and got to experience that. It was a Commonwealth Club trip, and if those of you that have not been on a Commonwealth Club trip, we've been on six. We're going to continue to go on more. But the real question that I have for you is right now we're in negotiations with the nuclear issue. And there's a good chance that sanctions will be lifted in Iran. What is your opinion about Iran's position in the Middle East, assuming the sanctions are lifted and there's some accord?
Well, purely economic, there's tremendous potential. And you sense that from the large multinationals, other companies chomping at the bit to get back into Iran. It has a large population. It's fairly sophisticated, a large middle class. It's had years under sanctions, so there's clearly pent-up demand for a whole array of goods and services there. The potential is tremendous. From a pure economic standpoint, other things being equal, which is a heroic assumption we like to use, ceteris paribus, the only two Latin words I know in economic, as they apply to economics, other things being equal, tremendous opportunities for trade between Iran and the Gulf countries. The problem is, politically, they've been at each other's throats for years to a greater or lesser extent. The agreement itself, if it's not accepted, if it's not considered viable, not only here in the U.S., but in the Middle East, then you're left with the risk of an arms race. And that's to no one's advantage. Resources are diverted toward an arms buildup. The political tensions prevent the growth of trade-driven growth from developing fully. But early on, certainly, if sanctions were suddenly lifted, the opportunities in Iran itself would be tremendous, and they'd have the financing for it because their oil exports would go up as well. Difficult market, prices would probably come down, but the revenue increase would be tremendous.
Our thanks to Gary Schlossberg, Vice President and Senior Economist for Wells Capital Management. We also want to thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Tom Burkhart, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.